keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you feeling them flares. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah, just nod your head with it. So explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it. No scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool. Hear my heartbeat beating to the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind. Oh no, it's ponderoso. Dope, so no overdose, cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd no, we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock like I told you. I'm doing this.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio. You're here with LaVon. It's Friday. Happy September 12th. It's 2014 still, believe it or not. We've had an interesting week. Thanks for joining us again. You can check us out Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, same time, same place, UCY.TV. It's an awesome network. I recommend that you check out the other programs that are being displayed proudly. This evening, to balance out the week's news, we're going to read, well, I'm going to read, story time. Well, this gets requested a lot. A lot of people are always like, LaVon, read more stories so I don't have to do it. Interesting fact. I just heard from my buddy who works in marketing, and he specializes in SEO, and he's a Google partner. He tells me that, startling, the average American / human spends about 7 seconds on a web page. So our attention span is very small. So to help you with your short attention span, just kidding, I'm going to read to you a little bit from a book by Desmond Morris called The Naked Ape. He is a zoologist, and he in this book treats us just like the animal we are, and proposes some ideas and perspective, shares a perspective that perhaps you haven't explored. So we'll get into this book this evening, we'll see how far we get. And we'll continue, you can continue independently, or we can have another story time coming up sometime soon. So, I'll begin with, first of all, let me say how awesome this is. I have a first edition of this book from 1967. It's super crunchy, and it smells ancient. It's awesome. So I'll try and be nice to it as I read it to you. Here we go. There are 193 living species of monkeys and apes. 192 of them are covered with hair. The exception is the naked ape, self-named Homo sapiens. I said homeo. This unusual and highly successful species spends a great deal of time examining his higher motives and an equal amount of time studiously ignoring his fundamental ones. He is proud that he has the biggest brain of all the primates, but attempts to conceal the fact that he also has the biggest penis, preferring to accord his honor falsely to the mighty gorilla. He is an intensely vocal, acutely exploratory, overcrowded ape, and it is high time we examine his basic behavior. I'm a zoologist, and the naked ape is an animal. He He is therefore fair game for my pen, and I refuse to avoid him any longer, simply because some of his behavior patterns are rather complex and highly impressive. My excuse is that, in becoming so rude, Homo sapiens has remained a naked ape nevertheless. In acquiring lofty new motives, he has lost none of the earthly old ones. This is frequently a cause of some embarrassment to him, but his old impulses have been with him for millions of years, new ones a few thousands at most, and there is no hope of quickly shrugging off the accumulated genetic legacy of this whole evolutionary past. He would be far less worried and more fulfilled as an animal if only he would face up to this fact. Perhaps this is where a zoologist can help. One of the strangest features of previous studies of naked ape behavior is that they have nearly always avoided the obvious. The early anthropologists rushed off to all kinds of unlikely corners of the world in order to unravel the basic truth about our nature, scattering to remote cultural backwaters so atypical and unsuccessful that they are nearly extinct. They return with startling facts about the bizarre mating customs, strange kinship systems, or weird ritual procedures of these tribes, and use this material as though it were of central importance to the behavior of our species as a whole. The work done by these investigators was, of course, extremely interesting and most valuable in showing us what can happen when a group of naked apes becomes sidetracked into a cultural blind alley. It revealed just how far from the normal our behavior patterns can stray. This was anything about the typical behavior of typical naked apes. This can only be done by examining the common behavior patterns that are shared by all the ordinary, successful members of major cultures, the mainstream specimens who together represent the mass majority. Biologically, this is the only sound approach. Against this, the old-style anthropologist would have argued that his technologically simple tribe groups are nearer the heart of the matter than the members of advanced civilizations. I submit that this is not so. The simple tribal groups that are living today are not primitive. They are stifled. Sorry, that word was like... This is a really old book, so I couldn't really see that one there. Hey guys, welcome back. Sorry about that, I lost you for a second. I'll continue. Truly primitive tribes have not existed for thousands of years. The naked ape is essentially an exploratory species, and any society that has failed to advance has in some sense failed, has gone wrong. Something has happened to hold it back, something that is working against the natural tendencies of the species to explore and investigate the world around it. The characteristics that earlier anthropologists studied in these tribes may as well be the very features that have interfered with the progress of the groups concerned. It is therefore dangerous to use this information as a basis for any general schemes of our behavior as a species. Psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, by contrast, have stayed nearer home and have concentrated on clinical studies of mainstream specimens. Much of their earlier material, although not suffering from the weakness of the anthropological information, also has an unfortunate bias. The individuals on which they have based their pronouncements are, despite their mainstream background, inevitably aberrant or failed specimens in some respect. If they were healthy, successful, and therefore typical individuals, they would not have to seek psychiatric aid and would have not have contributed to the psychiatrist's store of information. Again, I do not wish to belittle the value of this research. It has given us an immensely important insight to the way in which our behavior patterns can break down. I simply feel that in attempting to discuss the fundamental biological nature of our species as a whole, it is unwise to place too great emphasis on the earlier anthropological and psychiatric findings. I should add that the situation in anthropology and psychiatry is changing rapidly. Many modern research works in this field are recognizing the limitations of earlier investigations and are turning more and more to studies of typical, healthy individuals. As one investigator expressed it recently, the cart before the horse. We have tackled the abnormals and we are only now beginning, a little late in the day, to concentrate on the normals. I don't like that. I don't like that they're saying people who have psychiatric issues are not deemed valuable to conduct research. I guess if you're trying to find, like, what is normal, you need to have experience with all types of demographics, but that's just me. He says, I approach and I propose to use this book, draw its material from three main sources: the information about our past as unearthed by paleontologists and based on fossil and other remains of our ancient ancestors; two, the information available from animal behavior studies of the comparative ethologists based on detailed observations of a wide range of animal species, especially our closest living relatives, the monkeys and the apes; and three, the information that can be assembled by simple, direct observation of the most basic... And widely shared behavior patterns of the successful mainstream specimens from the major contemporary cultures of the naked ape itself. Because of the size of this task, it will be necessary to oversimplify in some manner. The way I shall do this is to largely ignore the detailed ramifications of technology and verbalization and concentrate instead on those aspects of our lives that have obvious counterparts in other species, such as feeding, grooming, sleeping, fighting, mating, and caring for the young. When faced with these fundamental problems, how does the naked ape, you and I, react? How do his reactions compare with those of other monkeys and apes? In particular respect, he is unique, and how his oddities relate to his special evolutionary story is interesting. In dealing with these problems, I shall realize that I shall run the risk of offending a number of people. Ooh, goody. There are some who will prefer not to contemplate their animal selves. They may consider that I have degraded our species by discussing it in a crude animal terms. I can only assure them that this is not my intention. There are others who will resent any zoological invasion of their specialist arena, but I believe this approach can be of great value and that whatever its shortcomings, it will open new and in some ways unexpected light on the complex nature of our extraordinary species. So, we'll move into the origins of the naked ape. There is a label on a cage at a certain zoo that states simply, "This animal is new to science." Inside the cage, there sits a small squirrel. It has black feet, and it comes from Africa. No black-footed squirrel has ever been found in that continent before. Nothing is known about it, and it has no name. For the zoologist, it presents an immediate challenge. What is it about its way of life that has made it unique? How does it differ from the 366 other living species of squirrels already known and described? Somehow, at some point in the evolution of the squirrel family, the ancestors of this animal must have split off from the rest and established themselves as an independent breeding population. What was it in the environment that made it possible for their isolation as a new form of life? The new trend must have started out in a small way, with a group of squirrels in one area becoming slightly changed and better adapted to the particular conditions there. But at this stage, they would still be able to interbreed with their relatives nearby. The new form would be at a slight advantage in its special region, but it would be no more than a race of the basic species and could be swamped out, reabsorbed into the mainstream at any point. If, as time passed, the new squirrels became more and more perfectly tuned in to their particular environment, the movement would eventually arrive when it would be advantageous for them to become isolated from possible contamination by their neighbors. At this stage, their social and sexual behavior would undergo special modifications, making interbreeding with other kinds of squirrels unlikely and eventually impossible. At first, their anatomy may have changed and become better at coping with a special food, but later, their mating calls and displays would also differ, ensuring that they attract only mates of the new type. At last, a new species would have evolved, separate and discrete, a unique form of life, a 367th kind of squirrel. When we look at the unidentified squirrel as it sits in the zoo, we can only guess about these things, and we can be certain about is that the markings on its fur, its black feet, indicate that it is a new form. But these are only the symptoms, the rash that gives the doctor a clue about his patient's disease. To really understand the new species, we must use these clues only as a starting point, telling us that there is something worth pursuing. We might try to guess at the animal's history, but that would be presumptuous and dangerous. Instead, we will start by humbly by giving it a simple and obvious label. We will call it the African black-footed squirrel. Now, we must observe and record every aspect of its behavior and structure to see how it differs from or is similar to the other squirrels. Then, little by little, we can piece together its story. The great advantage we have when studying such animal is that we ourselves are not black-footed squirrels, a fact which forces us into an attitude of humility that is becoming to proper scientific investigation. How different things are, how depressingly different, when we attempt to study the human animal. Even for the zoologist, who is used to calling an animal, it is difficult to avoid the arrogance of subjective involvement. We can try to overcome this to some extent by deliberately and rather coyly approaching the human being as if they were another species, a strange form of life on the discussing table, awaiting analysis. How do we begin? As with the squirrel, we can start by comparing him with other species that appear to be the closely related. From his teeth, his hands, his eyes, and various other anatomical features, he is obviously a primate of some sort, but a very odd kind. Just how odd it becomes clear when we lay out in a long row the skins of 192 living species of monkeys and apes and try to insert a human pelt at a suitable point somewhere in the long line of the series. Whenever we put it, it looks out of place. Eventually, we are driven to position it right at one end of the row of skins, next to the hides of tailless great apes and the chimpanzees and the gorilla. Even here, it is obtrusively different. The legs are too long, the arms are too short, and the feet are rather strange. Clearly, this species of primate has developed a special kind of locomotion, which has modified its basic form. But there is another characteristic that cries out for attention. The skin is virtually naked. Except for the conspicuous tufts of hair on the head, the armpits, and around the genitals, the skin surface is completely exposed. When compared with the other primate species, the contrast is dramatic. True, some species of monkeys and apes have small naked patches of skin on their rumps, their faces, or their chests, but nowhere amongst the other 192 species is there anything even approaching the human condition. At this point, and without further investigation, it is justifiable to name this new species the naked ape. It is a simple, descriptive name based on a simple observation, and it makes no special assumptions. Perhaps it will help to keep a sense of proportion and maintain our objectivity. Get thirsty. Okay, so I'll continue here. Starting at this stage, staring at this strange specimen and puzzling over the significance of its unique features, the zoologist now has to start making comparison. Where else is nudity a premium? The other primates are no help, so it means looking further afield. A rapid survey of mammals soon proves that they're remarkably attached to their productivity, furry covering, and that very few of the 4,237 species in existence have seen fit to abandon it. Unlike their reptilian ancestors, mammals have acquired the great physiological advantage of being able to maintain a constant high body temperature. This keeps the delicate machinery of the body process tuned in for top performance. It is not a property to be endangered or discarded lightly. The temperature controlling devices are of vital importance, and the possession of a thick, hairy, insulating coat obviously plays a major role in preventing heat loss. In intense sunlight, it also prevents overheating and damage to the skin from direct exposure to the sun's rays. If the hair has to go, then clearly there must be a very powerful reason for abolishing it. With few exceptions, this drastic step has been taken only when mammals have launched themselves into an entirely new medium. The flying mammals, the bats, have been forced to denude their wings, but they have retained their furriness elsewhere and can hardly be counted as naked species. The burrowing mammals have, in a few cases, the naked mole rat, the aardvark and the armadillo, for example, reduced their hair covering. The aquatic mammals such as whales, dolphins, porpoises, duggins. What's a duggin? I don't know what that is. Manatees and hippopotamuses have also gone naked as part of the general dwelling mammals, whether scampering about on the ground or clambering around in the vegetation. A densely hairy hide is the basic rule. Apart from those abnormally heavy giants, the rhinos and elephants, which have heating and cooling problems particular to themselves, the naked ape stands alone, marked off by his nudity from all the thousands of hairy, shaggy, or furry land-dwelling mammal species, mammalian species. At this point, the zoologist is forced to the conclusion that either he is dealing with a burrowing or an aquatic mammal, or there is something very odd, indeed unique, about the evolutionary history of the naked ape. Before setting out on the field trip to observe the animal in its present-day form, the first thing to do then is to dig back into its past and examine as closely as possible its immediate ancestors. Perhaps by examining the fossils and other remains, and by taking a look at the closest living relatives, we shall be able to gain some sort of picture of what happened as this new type of primate emerged and diverged from the family stock. It would take too long to present here all the tiny fragments of evidence that have been painstakingly collected over the past century. Instead, we will assume that this task has been done and simply summarize the conclusions that can be drawn from it. Combining the information available from the work of the fossil-hungry paleontologists with the facts gathered by the patient ape-watching ethologist, the primate group to which our naked ape belongs arose originally from primitive insectivore stock. These early mammals were small, insignificant creatures, scuttling nervously around in the safety of the forest, while the reptile overlords were dominating the animal scene. Between 80 and 50 million years ago, following the collapse of the great age of reptiles, these little insect eaters began to venture out into new territories.
There they spread and grew into many strange shapes. Some became plant eaters and burrowed under the ground for safety, or grew long, stilt-like legs with which to flee from their enemies. Others became long-clawed, sharp-toothed killers. Although the major reptiles had abdicated and left the scene, the open country was once again a battlefield. Meanwhile, in the undergrowth, small feet were still clinging to the security of the forest vegetation. Progress was beginning to be made here, too. The early insect eaters began to broaden their diet and conquer the digestive problems of devouring fruits, nuts, berries, buds. As they evolved into the lowliest forms of primates, their vision improved, the eyes coming forward to the front of the face, and the hands developed as food graspers. With three-dimensional vision, manipulating limbs, and slowly enlarging brains, they came more and more to dominate their arboreal world. Somewhere between 25 and 35 million years ago, these pre-monkeys had already started to evolve into monkeys proper. They were beginning to develop long, balancing tails and were increasingly considerable in body size. Some were on their way to becoming leaf-eating specialists, but most were keeping to a broad, mixed diet. As time passed, some of these monkey-like creatures became bigger and heavier. Instead of scampering and leaping, they switched to... what the hey does that say? Brachiating, which means swinging hand over hand along the underside of the branches. I didn't know that. This book is full of information. Their tails became obsolete. Their size, although making them more combustible in the trees, made them less weary of ground-level sorties. My brain's weird sometimes. Even so, at this stage, the eighth phase, there was much to be said for keeping to the lush comfort and easy pickings of their forest of Eden. Only if the environment gave them a rude shove into the great open spaces would they be likely to move. Unlike the early mammalian explorers, they had become specialized in forest existence. Millions of years developed had gone into perfecting this forest, and if they left now, they would have to compete with by this time, highly advanced ground-living herbivores and killers. And so, there they stayed, munching their fruit and quietly minding their own business. It should be stressed that this ape trend was for some reason taking place only in the old world. Monkeys had evolved separately and as advanced tree dwellers in both the old and new world, but the American branch of the primates never made the ape grade. In the old world, on the other hand, ancestral apes were spreading over a wide forest area from Western Africa at one extreme to Southern Asia on the other. Today, the remnants of this development can be seen in the African chimpanzees and gorillas, in the Asian gibbons and orangutans. Between these two extremes, the world is now devoid of hairy apes. The lush forests have gone. What happened to the early apes? We know that the climate began to work against them, and that by a point somewhere around 15 million years ago, the forest strongholds had become seriously reduced in size. The ancestral apes were forced to do one of the two things. Either they had to cling on to what was left of their old forest homes, or, in almost a biblical sense, they had to face expulsion from the garden. The ancestors of the chimpanzees, gorillas, gibbons, and orangs stayed put, and their numbers have been slowly dwindling ever since. The ancestors of the only other surviving ape, the naked ape, struck out, left the forest, and threw themselves into competition with the already efficient adapted ground dwellers. It was a risky business, but in terms of evolutionary success, But in terms of evolutionary success, it paid dividends. The Naked Ape success story from this point on is well known, but a brief summary will help, because it is vital to keep in mind the events which followed if we are to gain an objective understanding of the present-day behavior of the species. Faced with a new environment, our ancestors encountered a bleak prospect. They had to become either better killers than the old-time carnivores or better grazer than the old-time herbivores. We know today that, in a sense, success has been won on both scores, but agriculture is only a few thousand years old, and we are dealing in millions of years. Specialized exploitation of the plant life of the open country was beyond our early ancestors and had to await the development of advanced techniques of modern times. The digestive system necessary for a direct conquest of the grassland food supply was lacking. The fruit and nut diet of the forest could be adapted to a root and bulb diet at ground level, but limitations were severe. Instead of lazily reaching out to the end of the branch for a luscious ripe fruit, the vegetable-seeking ground ape would be forced to scratch and scrape painstakingly in the hard earth for his precious food. His old forest diet, however, was not all fruit and nut. Animal proteins were undoubtedly of great importance to him. He came originally, after all, from the basic insectivore stock, and his ancient arboreal home had always been rich in insect life. Juicy bugs, eggs, young helpless nestlings, tree frogs, and small reptiles were all grist his mill. What is more, they pose no great problems for his rather generalized Okay, thanks for bearing with me, guys. So we're talking about digestive systems here. Down on the ground, this source of food supply was by no means absent, and there was nothing to stop him increasing this part of his diet. At first, he was no match for the professional killer of the carnivore world. Even a small mongoose, not to mention a big cat, could beat him to the kill. But young animals of all kinds, helpless ones, or sick ones, were there for the taking. And the first step on the road to major meat eating was an easy one. The really big prizes, however, were poised on long, stilt-like legs, ready to flee at a moment's notice and quite impossible speeds. The protein-laden were beyond his grasp. This brings us to the last million years or so of the Naked Ape's ancestral history, and to a series of shattering and increasingly dramatic developments. Several things happened together, and it is important to realize this. All too often, when the story is told, the separate parts of it are spread out as one major advance led to another. But this is misleading. The ancestral ground apes already had large and high-quality brains. They had good eyes and efficient grasping hands. They inevitably, as primates, had some degree of social organization, with strong pressure on them to increase their prey-killing powers. Vital changes began to take place. They became more upright, faster, better runners, and their hands became freed from locomotive duties, strong, efficient weapon holders. Their brains became more complex, brighter, quicker decision makers. These things did not follow one another in a major such sequence. They blossomed together, minute advances being made first in one quality and then another, each urging the other on. A hunting ape, a killer ape, was in the making. It could be argued that evolution might have favored the less drastic step of developing a more typical cat or dog-like killer, a kind of cat ape or dog ape, by simple process of enlarging the teeth and nails into savage fangs and claw-like weapons, but this would have put the ancestral ground ape into direct competition with the already highly specialized cat and dog killers. I'd personally like to be a cat ape. Why didn't I get that upgrade? Not cool, not cool. Let's see. It would have meant that we would be competing with them on their own terms. Oh, alright. And the outcome would have no doubt been disastrous for the primates in question. For all we know, this may actually have been tried and failed so badly that the evidence has not been found. Instead, an entirely new approach was made, using artificial weapons instead of natural ones, and it worked. From tool using to tool making, that was the next step. And alongside this proved hunting techniques, not only in terms of weapons, but also in terms of social cooperation. The hunting apes were pack hunters, and as their techniques of killing were improved, so were their methods of social organization. Wolves in a pack deploy themselves, but the hunting ape already had a much better brain than a wolf and could turn it into such problems as a group communication and cooperation. Increasingly complex maneuvers could be developed. The growth of the brain surged on. Eventually, this was a hunting group of males. The females were too busy rearing the young to be able to play a major role in the catching and chasing of prey. As the complexity of the hunt increased and the forays became more prolonged, it became essential for the hunting ape to abandon the meandering, nomadic ways of its ancestors. A home base was necessary, a place to come back with the spoils, where the females and young could be waiting and could share the food. This step, as we shall see in later chapters, has had profound effects on many aspects of the behavior of even the most sophisticated naked apes of today. I call them napes. So the hunting ape became a territorial ape. His whole sexual, parental, and social patterns began to be affected. His old wandering fruit-plucking way of life has faded rapidly. He now has really left his Forest of Eden. He was an ape with responsibilities. He began to worry about the prehistoric equivalent of washing machines and refrigerators. He began to develop the home of comforts, fire, wood storage, artificial shelters. But this is where we must stop for the moment, for we are moving out of the realms of biology and into the realms of culture. The biological basis of these advanced steps lies in the development of a brain large and complex enough to enable the hunting ape to take them. But the exact form they assume is no longer a matter of specific genetic control. A forest ape that became a ground ape, that became a hunting ape, that became a territorial ape, has become a cultural ape, and we must call a temporary halt. It is worth reiterating here that in this book, we are not concerned with the massive cultural explosions that followed, of which the naked ape of today is so proud, the dramatic progression that led him in a mere half million years from making a fire to making a spacecraft. It is an exciting story, but the naked ape is in danger of being dazzled by it all and forgetting that beneath the surface gloss, he is still very much a primate. An ape's an ape, a varlet's a varlet, though they may be called a clad in silk or scarlet. Ooh, fancy words. Even a space ape must urinate, he says. Real funny, sir, real funny. I like this guy's voice. It's quite hilarious. I like that he's kind of prudish. But he can be. He knows his stuff. Granted, this book is like 45 years old. But we are here to gather perspectives, right? So only by taking a hard look at the way in which we have originated and then by studying the biological aspects of the way we behave as a species today can we really acquire a balanced objective understanding of our extraordinary existence. If we accept the history of our evolution as it has been outlined, then one fact stands out clearly, namely that we have arisen essentially as primate predators. Amongst existing monkeys and apes, This makes us unique, but major conversions of this kind are not unknown in other groups. The giant panda, for instance, is a perfect case of the reverse process. Whereas we are vegetarians turned carnivores, the panda is a carnivore turned vegetarian. And like us, in many ways, an extraordinary and unique creature. The point is that a major switch of this sort produces an animal with a dual personality. Once over the threshold, it plunges into its new role with great evolutionary energy, so much so that it carries with it many of its old traits. Insufficient time has passed for it to throw off all of its old while it is hurriedly donning the new ones. When the ancient fishes first conquered dry land, their new terrestrial qualities raced ahead while they continued to drag their old watery ones with them. It takes millions of years to perfect a dramatically new animal model, and the pioneer forms are usually very odd mixtures indeed. The naked ape is such a mixture. His whole body, his way of life, was geared to a forest existence. And then, suddenly in evolutionary terms, he was jettisoned into a world where he could survive only if he began to live like a brainy, weapon-toting wolf. We must examine now exactly how this affected not only his body, but especially his behavior, and in what form we experience the influence of this legacy at the present day. One way of doing this is to compare the structure and the way of life of a pure fruit-picking primate with a pure carnivore. Once we have cleared our minds about the essential differences that relate to their two contrasted methods of feeding, we can then re-examine the naked ape situation to see how the mixture has been worked out. The brightest stars in the carnivore galaxy are, on the one hand, the wild dogs and wolves, and, on the other, the big cats such as the lions, tigers, and leopards. They are beautifully equipped with the delicacy perfected sense organs. Their sense of hearing is acute, and their external ears can twist this way and that to pick up the slightest rustle or snort. Their eyes, although poor on static detail and color, are incredibly responsive to the tiniest movement. Their sense of smell is so good that it is difficult for us to comprehend it. They must be able to experience the virtual landscape of odors. Not only are they capable of detecting an individual smell with unerring precision, but they are also able to pick up the separate component odors of a complex smell. Experiments carried out with dogs in 1953 indicated that their sense of smell was between 1,000,000 and 1,000,000 times as accurate as ours. These astonishing results have since been cued, and later, more careful tests have not been able to confirm them. Again, this book's really old. But even the most cautious estimates put the dog's sense of smell at about 100 times better than ours. So it's somewhere between 1,000,000 and 1,000,000, or just 100 times. We're not sure. In addition to this first-rate sensory equipment, the wild dogs and big cats have a wonderfully athletic physique. The cats have been specialized as lightning sprinters, and the dogs as long-distance runners of great stamina. At the kill, they can bring into action powerful jaws, sharp, savage teeth, and in the case of big cats, massively muscular frontal limbs armed with huge, dagger-pointed claws. For these animals, the act of killing has become a goal in itself, and consumerary fact. It is true that they seldomly kill wantonly or wastefully. But if, in captivity, one of these carnivores is given ready-killed food, its urge to hunt is far from satisfied. Every time a domestic dog is taken for a walk by its master, or has a stick thrown for it to chase and catch, it is having its basic need to hunt catered for in a way that no amount of canned dog food will subdue. Even the most overstuffed domestic cat demands a nocturnal prowl and the chance to leap on an unexpected bird. Their digestive system is geared to accept comparatively long periods of fasting followed by bloating gorges. Hence, can eat 1/5 of its total body weight at one meal, the equivalent of you or me devouring a 30 to 40 pound steak in one sitting. Their food is of high nutritional value, and there is little wastage. Their faces, however, are messy and smelly, and defecation involves special behavior patterns. In some cases, the feces are actually buried and the site carefully covered over. In others, the act of defecating is always carried out by a considerable distance from the home. When young cubs foul in the den, the feces are eaten by the mother, and the home is kept clean in this way. Ooh, yummy. Simple food storage is undertaken. Carcasses or parts of them may be buried, as with the dogs and certain kinds of cats, or they may be carried up into a tree ladder, as with the leopard. The periods of insensitive athletic activity during the hunting and killing phases are interspersed with the periods of great laziness and of relaxation. During the social encounters of the savage weapons, so vital to the kill, constitute a potential threat to life and limb and any other minor disputes and rivalries. If two wolves or two lions fall out, they are both so heavily armed that the fighting could easily, in a matter of seconds, lead to mutilation or death. This could seriously endanger the survival of the species, and during the long course of the evolution that gave these species their lethal prey-killing weapons, they have a necessity of also to develop powerful inhibitions about using their weapons on other members of their own species. These inhibitions appear to have a specific genetic basis. They do not have to be learned. Special submissive postures have been evolved which automatically appease a dominant animal and inhibit its attack. The position of these animals, of these signals, is a vital part of the way of the life of pure carnivores. The actual method of hunting varies from species to species, and the leopard is a matter of solidarity. Stalking. Or hiding, and the last minute pounces. For the cheetah, it is a careful prowl followed by an all-out sprint. For the lion, it is usually a group action, which the prey is driven into a panic by one lion towards the other's hiding. That's sneaky. For a pack of wolves, it may involve an encircling maneuver followed by a group kill. For a pack of African hunting dogs, it's typically a ruthless drive, with one dog after another going into the attack until the fleeing prey is weakened from the loss of blood. Recent studies in Africa have revealed that the spotted hyena is also a savage pack hunter and not, as it has always been thought, primarily a scavenger. The mistake has been made because hyena packs form only at night, and minor scavenging has always been recorded during the day. When dusk falls, the hyena becomes a ruthless killer, just as efficient as the hunting dog during the day. Up to 30 animals may hunt together. They easily outpace the zebras or antelopes they are pursuing, which dare not travel at their full daytime speeds. The hyenas start tearing at the legs of its prey until it's sufficiently wounded to fall back from the fleeting herd. All the hyenas then converge on this one, tearing out its soft parts until it drops and is killed. Ow! Hyenas base themselves at communal densities. That's an interesting choice. The group or clan using this home base... I'm sorry, it says den sites. The group or clan using this home base may number between 10 and 100. Females stick closely to the area around the base, but the males are more mobile and may wander off into other regions. There is a considerable aggression between clans if wandering individuals are caught off their own clan territory, but there is little aggression between the members of any one clan. Food sharing is known to be practiced in a number of species. Of course, at a large kill, there is enough meat for the whole hunting group, and there need be little squabbling. Instances, the sharing is taken further than that. African hunting dogs, for instance, are known to regurgitate food to one another after the hunt is over. In some cases, they have done this to such an extent that they have become referred to as having a communal stomach. Carnivores with young go to considerable trouble to provide food for their growing offspring. Lionesses will hunt and carry meat back to the den, or they will swallow large hunks of it and then regurgitate it for their cubs. While lions have occasionally been reported to assist in this matter, but it does not appear to be a common practice. Male wolves, on the other hand, have been known to travel up to 15 miles to obtain food for both the female and her young. Large meaty bones may be carried back for the young to gnaw, or hunks of meat may be swallowed at the kill and then regurgitated at the entrance to the den. These, then, are some of the main features of the specialist carnivores as they relate to their hunting way of life. How do they compare with those of the typical fruit-picking monkeys and apes? The sensory equipment of the higher primates is much more dominated by the sense of vision than the sense of smell. In their tree-climbing world, seeing is far more important than smelling, and the snout has shrunk considerably, giving the eyes a much better view. In searching for food, the colors of fruits are helpful clues. And like the carnivores, primates have evolved good color vision. Their eyes are also better at picking out static details. Their food is static, and detecting minute movements is less vital than recognizing subtle differences in the shapes and texture. Hearing is important, but less so than the tracking killers. And their external ears are smaller and lack the twisting mobility of those of the carnivores. The sense of taste is more refined, the diet is more varied, and the high-flavored. There is more to taste. In particular, there is a strong positive response between two sweet-tasting objects. The primitive physique is good for climbing and clambering, but is not built for high-speed sprinting on the ground. Or for lengthy endurance feats. This is the agile body of an acrobat rather than the body frame of a powerful athlete. The hands are good for grasping, but not for tearing or striking. The jaws and teeth are reasonably strong, but nothing like the massive clamping, crunching apparatus of the carnivores. The occasional killing of small, insignificant prey requires no gargantuan effort. Killing is not, in fact, a basic part of primates' way of life. Feeding is spreading out through much of the day. Instead of great gorging feast followed by long fasts, the monkey and apes keep on and keep on munching, a life of non-stop snacks. That sounds awesome. There are, of course, periods of rest, typically in the middle of the day and during the night, but the contrast is nevertheless a striking one. Static food is always there, just waiting to be plucked and eaten. All that is necessary is for the animal to move from one feeding place to another. As their tastes change, or as the forests come in and out of season, no food storage takes place except in a very temporary way. In the bulging cheek pouches of certain monkeys. The feces are less smelly than those of the meat eaters, and no special behavior has developed to do with their disposal, since they drop down out of the trees and away from the animals. As the group is always on the move, there is little danger of a particular area becoming fouled or smelly. Even the great apes that bed down in the special sleeping nest make a new bed and a new site every night, so that there is little need to worry about the nest sanitation. Because of its static nerve nature and abundance of the food, there is no need for this primate group to split up and search for it. They can move, flee, rest, and sleep together in a close-knit community, with every member remembering an eye on the movements and actions of another, keeping an eye. Each individual at any one moment have a reasonably good idea of what everyone is doing. This is a very non-carnivore procedure. Even in those species of primates that do split up from time to time, the smaller unit is never composed of a single individual. A solitary monkey or ape is a vulnerable creature. It lacks the powerful nature weapons of the carnivore, and in isolation fails to easy prey of the stalking killers. The cooperative spirit that is present in such pack hunters as wolves is largely absent from the world of primates. Competitiveness and dominance is an order to his day. Competition is the social hierarchy, of course, present in both groups, but less tempered by cooperative action in the case of monkeys and apes. Complicated, coordinated maneuvers are also necessary. Sequenced of feeding actions do not need to be strung together in such a complex way. The primate can live much more from minute to minute, from hand to mouth. But the primate's food supply is around it for the taking. There is little need to cover great distances. Groups of wild gorillas, the largest of the living primates, have been carefully studied and their environment traced so that we know that they have traveled on the average about a third of the miles a day. Sometimes they move only a few hundred feet. Carnivores, by the contrast, must frequently travel many miles on a single hunting trip. In some instances, they have been known to travel over 50 miles on a hunting journey, taking several days before returning to their home base. This act of returning to a fixed home is typical of the carnivores, but is far less common among the monkeys and apes. True, a group of primates will live reasonably clearly defined homes, but at night will probably bed down wherever it happens to end up in its day. It will get to know the general region in which it lives because it's always wandering back and forth, but it will tend to use the whole area in a much more haphazard way. Also, the interaction between one troop and the next will be far less defensive and less aggressive than is the case with the carnivores. A territory is, by definition, a defended area. And primates are not, therefore, typically territorial animals. A small point, but one that is relevant here, is that carnivores have fleas, but primates do not. Monkeys and apes are plagued by lice and certain other external parasites. But, contrary to popular opinion, they are completely flealess, and for one very good reason. To understand this, it is necessary to examine the life cycle of a flea. This insect lays its eggs not on the body of its host, but amongst the detritus of its victim's sleeping quarters. The eggs take 3 days to hatch into small crawling maggots. These larvae do not feed on blood, but on the waste matter that has accumulated from the dirt or the den layer. After 2 weeks, they spin a cocoon and pupate. We'll continue next week, guys. Thanks for joining me. I will see you next Friday. Check us out on Monday at 8 o'clock.
Yo, here we go through the stereo.